This is Stateside for Michigan Radio. I'm Lester Graham. Hope your Friday's going okay. Michigan Radio's investigative reporter Lindsay Smith says not properly testing for lead might mean your water supply is worse than you think.
Just if you did a second sample, 50% of water systems in the country will be bumped above this action level.
We'll talk to a college student who started a program to help young black men who go to a mostly white college.
Providing them social support so that they don't experience too much culture shock as they transition to a predominantly white institute or PWI.
Actor, musician, Michigander Jeff Daniels talks about his career.
I'm busier now than I've been before Newsroom. It's really kind of amazing for me.
Plus, he picks up the guitar for us, and we'll introduce you to our latest artisan of Michigan.
I did a little bit of weaving, making rattan and bamboo furniture in Africa.
All that and more. Stick around after. Welcome to Stateside. I'm Lester Graham. Coming up later this hour.
About 10 years ago, I could see playing the jerk father, you know, a variation of Squid and the Whale or Terms of Endearment character grown up, and I'd be the jerk father to some 28-year-old who's making $10 million and can't hit his mark. And I just said, I don't think that's where the career's going to go. It's been a great run. And then Aaron Sorkin and Newsroom called.
We talk with Jeff Daniels about his career. But first, the concerns about drinking water pipes made of lead has spread from Flint to other Michigan towns and cities. Investigative reporter Lindsay Smith is following that story. She joins us now. You reported a few weeks ago the state proposed sweeping changes to regulations on lead in water. Governor Rick Snyder calls the current regulations dumb and dangerous. What do we know about those proposed changes? What's going on?
Well, the public should be getting these new draft proposals soon. There is a public meeting that's on the DEQ's calendar for November 29th. So if you are really interested in this topic, you can check that out. They will be a little bit different, but I expect some of the big changes are still on the table. You're talking about the level, the action level that is acceptable to have lead in water.
That's the parts per billion of lead in the water.
Correct. And it's right now it's set at 15 parts per billion. The state is talking about lowering that to 10 parts per billion, which would be the toughest standard of any state in the country. So that would be a big change. You're also talking about cities having to replace lead pipes, even if they don't have high lead levels, and sort of some of the technical ways that cities do that to make sure that they don't make the problems worse. Another big change that is, I mean, it's a small change, but it can make a big difference for water systems in the state with lead lines, and that is this idea of a second draw sample.
A second draw sample? What is that?
Okay, so you've got a sampling technique, right? You've got bottles that you're going to take water and fill them out of your faucet. Right now, the way it's set up, you take your first draw sample. So that's essentially you put the bottle right underneath the faucet, you open up the faucet full blast, and that is the first draw. The thing about the first draw sample is you are only getting the water that has sat in the pipes that are really, really close to the faucet. It's a liter, so it's just not that much water. The main risk, if you have a lead pipe, is actually the water that's out in the road, in the lead pipe. And that is not going to get captured in a first draw sample. So the idea of having a second draw sample, whether it's right after a first, but ideally it's a period of time or a volume of water, that you would take a sample from that, and then you would use that to calculate whether or not your system is meeting the action level.
So let me follow you. We've got the big main out in the street.
Yep.
We might have a lead pipe between the big main and the house.
Correct.
And the water that's just kind of sitting there for a few hours, kind of, you know, marinating in this lead pipe.
It's a good way to put it.
Is not going to come out of the tap as soon as we turn it on because we've got all our piping in the house. That has to be kind of flushed out first before that lead-soaked water gets up to the tap. That's what you're saying.
Yes, and research has found that that slug of water is where the highest concentration of lead is usually found. And the way the law is written right now, we are totally missing the most dangerous amount in your water when that slug comes through.
So cities that have okay lead levels by EPA standards right now, if they do the second draw, they might actually be in excess of the levels. And then if the governor gets his way and we lower the levels even more, that means a lot of cities could be above the lead levels in the state.
Yeah, this is, if I can put it this way, this is Virginia Tech Mark Edwards. He's been involved with the Flint water crisis, and this is his baby. He would love to see this second draw sample adapted in Michigan because he really feels like this is going to, even if you don't change the 10 parts per billion, even if you don't lower it, it will still expose. If there are any problems, it will give the public that knowledge. There was a 2015 study that was published in an industry journal. It laid out a few scenarios for this second draw sample. There can be a sequential sampling where you take a bunch of samples in a row and you take the highest one and use that. The study said that if we did that, 70% of water systems in the country could get bumped above that 15 parts per billion.
Wow.
If you do a standard volume instead of just a bunch of samples in a row, but just say after 30 seconds or after a minute, you just do like a period of time or something like that.
But that's going to vary from house to house,
right?
It
is going to, and it lowers the amount of systems. But in that case, just if you did a second sample, 50% of water systems in the country will be a bumped above this action level. So that is why Virginia Tech's Mark Edwards says that there has been pushback to this particular change.
To admit that we've been getting it wrong all these years, it's very hard for institutions to acknowledge that. We were told this problem was going to be fixed 10 years ago. And instead, you know, we keep waiting for these revisions and they never come. And, you know, the very thought that 50, 60, 70% of our biggest cities with lead pipes are suddenly going to have to tell people their water was not meeting the standard that's been in place for 25 years. That's hard for people to do.
So that's what Michigan is considering right now. And if Michigan does that, you know, that potentially is a game changer in some aspects in cities, with certainly with lead lines.
But we're not just playing around with numbers here. I mean, we're talking about what's our true lead levels in our water.
And I mean, I think it's important because, the bottom line is you can play with these numbers all day long. You know, pick your action level, pick your sampling, whatever. If it is my home, I want to know what's the worst case scenario I'm looking at here. And so that, if you can capture that better, at least the public will know about it. You know, right now you just are flushing that, you know, that biggest chunk down the drain.
Okay, so let's just leave the lead levels where they are at the EPA regulation for right now. A lot of the cities might be above that EPA level right now and not get that information from the water system because of the way they sample. So if we're underestimating this risk, especially in these cities in Michigan with lead pipes, how do we protect ourselves from possible lead exposure? What do we do?
This is actually, I learned a lot about this, and I think it is relatively easy to do some simple things to protect yourself and your family. One of the first things you should do, in my opinion, you should know if you have a lead pipe. If you can, right? Go into your basement. NPR has this amazing app. Takes you step by step, bring your phone with you, and it will show you how to, like, walk you through the process of trying to figure out if you have a lead pipe connecting your house or not. I think that's the basic step. If you can't do that, ask your city. Sometimes cities know this, sometimes they don't. Anyone can get a filter. So if you don't know, you can't figure it out, you're not sure, you still feel, like, nervous about it, NSF-rated lead filters will remove 99.9% of lead in your water. So if you can afford a filter, do that, especially vulnerable people. I'm talking about formula-fed infants, pregnant moms, people who are day laborers who drink a ton of water. Those kinds of people are at a higher risk, so you should consider getting a filter if you can. If you can't afford a filter, one of the easiest things you can do is flush your water. What I mean by that really is, if you go on vacation for a week, or you have a sink down in your basement that you only use once a month to hang out with your buddies at the bar downstairs, you know, make sure that you run your tap water first thing in the morning for 5 minutes. flush all that water that's been marinating in the lead pipes, right? Get it out of there. Get that out of the drain. And then when you have fresh new water, that lead levels, they always tend to go down after you flush your water for a while.
So about 5 minutes, you say, 5, 10 minutes, something like that, that might pop your water bill, but that's probably cheaper than putting a filter system in.
It really depends. Those filters can be as cheap as $20-$30. It depends on, you would pay a lot more if you're in Detroit or Flint, where water rates are higher than if you were in the city of Grand Rapids. I did that in Grand Rapids, even though I knew I had a copper pipe once I started reporting on this stuff, because I just felt like that water's sitting out in that copper pipe anyway. I don't know. So part of me every morning when I make my coffee, I run my water as I'm getting the coffee into the filter. And then by the time I, go to the bathroom and get my coffee ready to go, then I have that nice, fresh, new water that's not been sitting in my pipe, no matter what it is.
Before I let you go, you've been working on a new series of reports on lead in water for Michigan Radio. I know some people can't listen to the radio all the time. It's surprising, but it happens. So where can they find those stories?
You can find those stories completely on our website, michiganradio.org, and just search for Ripple Effects of Flint. And you can find today's story is really cool, Lester. Metro Detroit is where most of the lead lines are in Michigan. And we did a great mapping project where we tried to see how far the lead lines sort of went out into the suburbs of Detroit. So you can find a pretty comprehensive interactive map online right now, too.
Good tips. That's Lindsay Smith. She's our investigative reporter, continuing to find out how extensive Michigan's lead in water problem is. Thanks for coming in.
Oh, my pleasure.
Up next, we'll hear about a mentoring program for young black men at Michigan State University. And then we'll talk about what the U.S. Department of Agriculture is doing to regain the trust of minority and women farmers. Stay with us. This is Stateside from Michigan Radio. This is Stateside. I'm Lester Graham. Recently, the Annie E. Casey Foundation released a report that found Michigan's African-American kids are struggling in school. Nationwide, there is disparity between the education that kids of color receive and white kids. If people of color end up at a predominantly white college, it's not clear that they're going to get the resources and support they need there. At Michigan State University, Tim Hurd is doing something about that for young black men. Hurd founded Rising Black Men, a mentoring program, and he joins us now. Welcome to Stateside.
Thanks for having me.
Now, you're still a student at MSU, right?
Yes, I am a junior here now at Michigan State.
So what motivated you to start Rising Black Men?
So I was motivated to start Black Men due to the research that I did over the summer and Summer Research Opportunities Program. It was closing the opportunity gap for black males in K-12 education. And what I realized is there are a lot of adverse effects on black males, specifically in the K-12 education system. And I see how that can translate into college and why the retention rates are so low, specifically at predominantly white institutes regarding black males. And I kind of wanted to develop a solution to address this. And I know it's just not academics, but it's also a social factor as well, and just not feeling a sense of belonging. So I wanted to create that sense of belonging, that sense of support, and just provide a network so that, these students could get connected and feel accepted here on campus.
So how are you using your fellow students, upperclassmen, to help incoming students?
I'm using them to help with a part of the mentorship, specifically checking in with them once a week. And once a month, they'll have breakfast with the grads. So they kind of indirectly mentor the freshmen, and myself and the other eight mentors, we more so are more direct in our mentorship.
So what kind of, are some of the issues you'll be helping them with?
Some of the issues we'll be helping them with is just providing them social support so that they don't experience too much culture shock as they transition to a predominantly white institute or a PWI. And twice a month, we have learning objectives. So we had our two learning objectives for this past month. And our first one was how to navigate a predominantly white institute while being a black male and dealing with things such as microaggressions. And then talking about the divisiveness within our own community as black people. And if you speak articulate or you talk proper, you're quote unquote not black enough in some neighborhoods. And then our second discussion, we talked about purpose. So really, we're going to have learning objectives, and those are just going to be opportunities to inform them about different things and have deep conversations about things relevant to us as college students, and more specifically as black male college students, and then providing them their mentorship and getting them connected with faculty and things such as that.
Well, what kind of help are you getting from faculty or the university in general?
Yeah, so from faculty, I'm getting funding. I'm also getting mentorship. What I'm trying to do is create a pipeline. So I believe that we're still college students, and the students we're mentoring are college students as well. So we don't know everything. So we want to kind of get knowledge from an upper level, that upper level being more specifically the faculty and the assistant deans and deans of some of the colleges, and also the professors. So there are a lot of professors in the organization who mentor the mentors so that we can mentor the freshmen.
I understand you're also reaching out to young black men and boys in Lansing's elementary schools, middle schools, high schools. Would you tell us about that?
Yes, there's 35 freshman males, black males in this organization. So second semester, they'll mentor one high school male within the Lansing community. So Lansing Sexton, Lansing Everett, and even East Lansing. I've kind of been in contact with the Lansing superintendent and the East Lansing superintendent indirectly. What we have so far is setting up a program so that my freshmen can go over there and possibly create their own learning objective that we like we do here. And then for next year, I want to establish a even longer pipeline. So the high school will mentor the middle schools, and then middle schools will mentor the elementary schools, kind of similar to how we mentor the freshmen here on campus.
Now, you're going to be graduating before too long. How will Rising Black Men evolve as you go forward?
Yes, so I would love to continue this work upon graduation. And really what we're going to do is pass the torch in a way. We're going to send it off to the freshmen who have a lot of potential now, and they're going to take the positions of myself and the other mentors. And possibly I'll be attending Michigan State for grad school, so I'll still more than likely be there helping indirectly. I won't be the president, so to say, but I'll be like an advisor or just a keen ear about what's going on campus so that I can still provide some support. But I'll have an outline written and you can follow it, look at it, and very easily know how to run the program. And then also like the tutelage and the care and kind of like really just like giving the freshmen, especially some more freshmen some more attention and kind of grooming them to be in the position that I'm in so that there's a easy transfer.
How will you measure success? What metrics will you use to make sure you are getting what you want out of this?
So the first thing I will do to measure success is look at retention rates and look at how my freshmen and how everybody in the program is doing academically. So I want my freshmen to be here first semester and second semester and be here their entire college tenure. And I want them to successfully graduate here at Michigan State University. So that would definitely be the first thing that I focus on in terms of measuring success.
I read somewhere that Michigan State University has a larger number of freshmen African-Americans than it's had in a while.
Yes, I believe it's possibly one of the largest, if not the largest, incoming class of black freshmen, specifically in the Big Ten this year. I know that.
Is this a program that you would like to see go beyond MSU to maybe the Big Ten or maybe just a national program for African-American students?
Yes, definitely. So within, I have like, you know, 2-year plan, 3-year plan. So in 5 years, I plan on seeing this at every institution in the Big Ten. And I expect to see a Rising Black Man at Purdue, at Iowa, and every university, if applicable. And I believe it can happen because people are looking for, you know, especially students to create initiatives like this because it's a good thing. And I think that it can definitely help make an impact. And it increases retention rates. And it along with increasing retention rates, it makes the university look good because they're retaining their students. And I think every university wants to have wants to be able to say that they have a good retention rate and that their students come back and that they want to come back.
Tim Hurd is the founder and the president of Rising Black Men at Michigan State University. Thanks for talking with us.
Thank you.
A few weeks ago, we talked with a specialist in underserved farmers at the Michigan State University Center for Regional Food Systems. Shakara Tyler mentioned a class action lawsuit against the United States Department of Agriculture that alleged discrimination against black farmers. That case is called the Pigford Lawsuit. It claimed USDA loan officers and agents denied loans, lost applications, delayed applications, and otherwise discriminated against African-American farmers. After all was said and done, the settlement with the USDA was the largest federal settlement for civil rights violations in the nation. It amounted to more than $2 billion in loan forgiveness. Further lawsuits were filed by Native American, Latino, and women farmers, and further settlements were paid out by the government. Here to talk about what the USDA has done since those lawsuits are Brian Garner. He's the Senior Director of the Office of Civil Rights Farm Service Agency at the USDA. And James Redentz, who is the Deputy Administrator for Farm Loans Programs Farm Service Agency with the USDA. How did this kind of discrimination happen?
Well, this is really ancient history. The lawsuits were actually filed in the late 1990s. And most of the allegations were in the decade or so preceding the filing of the litigation. USDA and Farm Service Agency in particular have put together a variety of strategies to try and address that. Beyond that, Congress has made some public policy directions to help address the issue of the what had been a shrinking number of minority and underserved farmers across the country.
What is the USDA doing to regain the trust of minority and women farmers?
There are many initiatives that have been brought about by the department. One of them, for example, is LEP, Limited English Proficiency. When we talk about equal access under the law, everyone has the right and should have the opportunity to apply for different programs and services within USDA. We have outreach programs coming from our Deputy Administrator for Field Operations. So there are some things that are, I believe, very aggressive in terms of opportunities to actually bring the trust back to USDA.
What does that outreach look like? I mean, are you meeting with some of the people who were within the class action lawsuit to ask them, or are you having focus groups? What does outreach mean?
I'll give you an example. In one case, we were out in California. I say we. The department, FSA, a couple of other agencies were out in California meeting with Vietnamese fishers. These individuals had issues and complaints, and the biggest part of the complaint process was communications. And so we were able to go out there, meet in a group, speak about the programs that are available to those fishermen, and allay a lot of the concerns that they had about being able to be helped by USDA.
If we went to a group of them and just asked them, do you think you're being treated fairly now? What do you think the response would be?
In the era prior to the litigation, the program philosophy was what I would call a build it and they will come. In other words, the folks were in the office, but they were just really sitting and doing their jobs. But there was no incentive for them to make sure that these producers got the service that they needed. One of the initiatives that we implemented several years ago to address that is that we now have program performance goals. Congress has targeted some of the funding to producers that fall into these groups. We've also set performance goals for our field staff, our loan staff in particular, and they are held accountable for these goals to assure that the funding that is made available is properly utilized. Another initiative that we've undertaken, we've had a fairly aggressive, what we would call a marketing program. Again, making sure that we are out in the community, that our loan staff and other agency personnel are present at various events where we would expect to be able to meet with minority producers, to explain the programs, talk with them about what's available, and again, make sure that their needs are met as best the programs can meet them.
And that kind of thing is happening across the nation?
I think it's happening all over the place, yes.
This was the actions of personnel at the local level. What has the USDA done to ensure its officials at the county level are treating farmers all the same?
Well, there are a variety of things. Before the advent of the technology that we have today, of course, it was much more difficult to gather data and monitor events and situations. Today, even though our systems are not maybe what we would like them to be, we have a lot more capabilities, for example, to monitor in near real time loan application activity, when necessary, further investigate anomalies that arise. It's been quite a few years ago now, but Congress actually reserved or targeted a specific amount of our loan funding to go to what's referred to in the law as socially disadvantaged farmers, which basically is minority and female farmers. So those are some of the things that have changed and particularly allow us to assure that we know about the activities that are going on out there and can much more quickly intervene to address any anomalies that might occur.
With what kind of certainty can you say discrimination against Black, Latino, Indigenous, and women farmers has been eradicated throughout the USDA?
In terms of the loan programs, certainly nothing is 100%. We don't live in a perfect world. But I think our program results speak to the large success that we've had in that area. We've increased lending to those groups substantially. In the fiscal year that just ended, we made roughly 8,700 loans totaling about $832 million to farmers that fall into those groups. I think another indicator is we processed just over 40,000 loan applications. We only received 23 Farm Loan Program-related civil rights complaints. In other words, where a loan applicant or a borrower lodged a complaint alleging that their civil rights had been violated in some way.
What kind of training have these USDA officers at the local level, these agents and loan officers, gotten to ensure that we don't have the kind of discrimination that led to this class action lawsuit?
One of the major efforts coming from my office, which is the Office of Civil Rights, is to reach out to all managers to provide some level of civil rights training. We basically share what constitutes discrimination. And a lot of the training is customer service based. That's just a snapshot of what we do as an Office of Civil Rights.
What will tell you that you've successfully accomplished all of your goals to make sure that minority and women farmers are being treated fairly? What kind of metrics are you using?
I can't honestly say that all of our goals have been met. We're still pushing and pressing for opportunities to improve in our relationships with minority populations. I think that's ongoing, but we've made great strides. The numbers don't lie. And when I look at what was happening in 2007 versus 2017, it's remarkable what this agency has done. We go out and we spend money to make sure that everybody has an opportunity to learn, to glean from the civil rights perspective, and also to share with our customers. The 2008 Farm Bill required that we have what's called receipt for services, and that is a tool that allows us here at the national office to really hold accountable those in the field who are dealing with customers on a daily basis. And so when an individual comes into a county office or a service center, that person is given a receipt. They sign that receipt. That receipt is an immediate feedback for us. And I think that helps in terms of customer service. I think that's real big in the business that we're in. The other thing is that my office conducts state management reviews. We do a top-to-bottom look at a state office. We look at the county offices, and we determine that they are in compliance with civil rights regs, laws, and statutes.
Jim Redentz, in the farm loans programs, how do you measure success?
We're going to continually take steps to make sure that we don't let anything arise as did those many years ago. I'm held accountable for civil rights complaints in the farm loan programs that I'm responsible for. I have an incentive and I'm very committed to make sure that there aren't complaints, which means that the programs are being administered fairly and equitably. And we continue to look for other opportunities to strengthen the programs and make it easier for those folks to access them and easier for our field staff to deliver them as well.
That is Jim Redentz. He is the Deputy Administrator for Farm Loans Programs Farm Service Agency with the USDA. And we hear from Brian Garner. He's the Senior Director of the Office of Civil Rights Farm Service Agency at the USDA. Gentlemen, thanks very much for talking with us.
You're welcome.
Thank you. It's been our pleasure.
Thank you.
Coming up, we'll talk with actor, musician, and Michigander, Jeff Daniels.
I was concerned that the career was over. I think I'd messed the career around enough with going from Gettysburg to Dumb and Dumber and things like that to confuse the hell out of them. So that was kind of the method to the madness.
And we'll introduce you to our latest Artisan of Michigan. That's in 15 minutes here on Stateside from Michigan Radio. This is Stateside. I'm Lester Graham. My next guest needs no real introduction. You've seen him at the movies. You've seen him on TV. You might be a fan of his music, or perhaps you've attended performances at the Purple Rose in Chelsea and saw one of his plays. Jeff Daniels is in the studio. Welcome back.
Thank you.
You've been a busy guy. I mean, let's talk about what you've been up to lately. There's a film called The Catcher Was a Spy, which will soon be released. What was your role in that movie?
I played a general. Catcher Was a Spy. I remember doing that. Yeah, it's A Week in Prague with Paul Rudd and Paul Giamatti. It was great.
You were filming it last year. So.
Apparently, yeah.
So it's coming out a little later. Give us the thumbnail sketch about what that movie's about.
That's about World War II. Paul Rudd plays a guy that was a baseball player for the Red Sox. Don't ask me why. He ended up as a spy and hired to go into Germany to kind of thwart their building of the atomic bomb before the U.S. did. And apparently Paul Rudd's character was integral in that.
And that's The Catcher Was a Spy, to be released in 2018. This month, Netflix is releasing a limited series, a Western called Godless. You're in that. What should we expect from that?
That's a Western. Big, fat, 6-7 hour episodic Western. And Scott Frank wrote and directed it. I play a completely dysfunctional bad guy. It was a joy. It was an absolute joy to play. And you know, you're on a horse for 3 months. So there's that.
I understand you just finished shooting a 10-episode series for Hulu that will be released in the spring. It's called Looming Tower. What can you tell us about that?
That's about the run-up to 9/11. It's based on a Pulitzer Prize-winning book by Lawrence Wright called Looming Tower, and it's the lead-up to it. There was a guy in New York named John O'Neill, and he was with the counterterrorism unit in New York, and he was constantly in Washington trying to get information on this bin Laden guy in Al-Qaeda in the mid-90s, screaming about that this is something. And he got a lot of pushback. It's the story of him trying to get people to focus on bin Laden.
These are a variety of roles. You were in a newsroom for a long time. Were you ever concerned that you might get stereotyped?
I was concerned that the career was over. I think I'd messed the career around enough with going from Gettysburg to Dumb and Dumber and things like that to confuse the hell out of them. That was kind of the method to the madness.
So they can't peg you.
Yeah, they can't peg me. And there are jobs in between. You know, Clint Eastwood, he hired me for, Clint has a gun and gets the bad guy, one of those things, you know. And he said, if you can do Dumb and Dumber and you can do Gettysburg, you can do this. They're called jobs in between for an actor, especially one who's living in Michigan. So that worked out great. But it got to be the point that in about 10 years ago, I could see playing the jerk father you know, a variation of Squid and the Whale or Terms of Endearment character grown up, and I'd be the jerk father to some 28-year-old who's making $10 million and can't hit his mark. And I just said, I don't think that's where the career's going to go. It's been a great run. And then Aaron Sorkin and Newsroom called. And that's, I'm busier now than I've been before Newsroom. It's really kind of amazing for me.
Let's talk about Purple Rose for a moment. It's performing God of Carnage. You played a role in that across from the late James Gandolfini in New York. And I was told you were nominated for a Tony.
That happened, yeah.
So this play is special for you.
It is. And I saw it the other night, and they were so grounded. The acting style we have at the Purple Rose is designed to be as real as possible and as genuine. You don't see them acting. And it's kind of film acting on stage. You're in a medium close-up on our stage because the audience is so close. That demands that we believe every moment that you're in. You can't act this or perform this. You have to go through it and experience it. We can see you thinking. And so that's what these people are doing. There are portions of this production that are better than what we did, funnier, more real. You know, and then there are many others that are different and a different take on it and all that. I'm so thrilled with it. And I've had very little to do with it. I had a couple of meetings with Lauren Knox, the director, and Guy Sandville, the artistic director. But basically, you know, this might help, that might help. Good luck.
I was reading about the Purple Rose annual backyard barbecue benefit for the theater, and there's this auction, and the big item was a private concert by Jeff Daniels at the Bidwinner's home. Who won that? How'd that go?
And we were a little concerned that no one would want it. But it turned out that there were some folks that they generously gave. And then we were able to, you know, well, the runner-up, you get it too, and do that thing that they do at auction. And there was another foundation that it will match whatever the winning bid is, no matter what. So it turned out to be a great way to raise money. I've never been a fan of let's hold another dinner with tuxedos and I'll give a speech, and I can't stand that. And so let's find new and inventive ways. And I was sitting with some of the board members, and I what if we did that? And they go, that's a great idea, because it's, I enjoy doing it. Come into their living room. Brian Vander Ark of the Verve Pipe in Grand Rapids, Brian does this all the time, which is where I kind of got the idea. I know other people do it, but I've seen Brian. He just go, oh, no, it's great. And he talked me through it. It was like, okay, all right.
What do you play for him? You've got your guitar here. Can you give us a sample of what you might play if we were in my home?
Yeah, here's a little piece of something that it's when you drive by in a country road and you see the light on and the little ranch house, and you know that something's going on. It was a night like any other, after any other day, just me and my missus in CSI LA. She was perched on the couch, I was parked in the chair. Nothing's going on, no one's going nowhere. I turned off the TV, turned out the lights, turned to my missus, think I'll call it a night. When she didn't respond, I went to say it again. That's when I saw the state of mind my missus was in. She had her nose inside her Kindle, wooed by the words, her eyes fixated, stimulation stirred. I said, what's that you're reading? I was shocked to hear her say, I'm on the very last page of 50 Shades of Grey. She's reading 50 Shades of Grey. She's reading 50 Shades of Grey. Lord have mercy on the man and woman reading 50 Shades of Grey. There's that. So that, you know,
that's great.
You know, and I was told that book sold like gangbusters in the Bible Belt. Saw it on the internet. Must be true.
You're touring. You've been doing concerts with your son's band, the Ben Daniels Band, also touring, as you mentioned, with Brian Vander Ark. Tell me about touring with your son. How's that different than other tours?
I love playing music, and I understand that, you know, I'm known as an actor, not as a musician, and I'll never, whatever, wherever I've gotten to as an actor, I'll never get there as a musician. So I'm not even going to try. I'm just going to enjoy it. So why not, your son has a band, why not see if the stuff you're writing that they can get on it and here's what we hear and this is what we think it is and it fits and suddenly it you've got a band. And it's not a Viagra band, you know, like the guys my age, you know, you see those commercials and, you know, they're all kind of bopping on the one and the three and, you know, you're just these people are in their 30s, they're young, they can play. And then to be on stage with your son and Lucas, my son, is the tour manager. And it's just, what a way to spend time with your kids, you know. It's just great. We're playing them. One of the ones I look forward to is the Michigan Theater Show on the Saturday night of Thanksgiving weekend. I used to do that a lot.
Yeah, I think it's November 25th.
Yeah, and it was back in the day. It was Jeff Daniels and friends, and I'd invite a whole bunch of people. But then they moved the Michigan-Ohio State game to that day. And so I said, I'm not competing with it. I'm getting out of here. Because I don't trust ESPN and ABC or whomever to Fox, whoever, Big Ten. Suddenly it's an 8 o'clock game. And you're going, well, that's just horrible. But they're saying they're going to keep it at noon. You got a lot of people walking around Ann Arbor looking for something to do. Those who aren't hammered, looking for something to do at night. And I think it'll be a great night. Be a great night for us.
Besides both being Michiganders, how'd you get together with Brian Vander Ark?
Jim Fleming is my music agent, and he was working with Brian. And he said, you know, you might have fun writing with him. And I always write alone, you know, as a playwright and as a songwriter. I've never been one of those co-writer guys. Brian, I met him and it was great and terrific. And he sent me a song called My Little Town that he'd kind of had half done. So I said, all right. So I just threw some ideas and emailed him. And then he finished it and he recorded it. He did another one called Overboard about a love triangle. And I kind of helped threw some images at him and he did that. And then I said, why don't we write one together? So we spent about 6-7 months back and forth, emailing back and forth. What about this? And, you know, let me work on that second verse of that one. And it was great. And then we got in the studio and recorded the 10 or 12 best songs that we thought we had. And it was great. It was all about the songwriting.
Well, can we hear a little bit of one of them?
Yeah. Old North Wind wants to read me my last rites. This ain't no place to die. Warm beers with the boys who've never been won't take very long tonight. Every bar stool's occupied, truckers, farmers, and me. Another brawl in the parking lot. Babe, why'd you have to leave? Taking I-94. Shut up, get in, lock the door. I do some highway cruising. Tired of love and losing. Taking I-94. Goes on.
Jeff Daniels, ladies and gentlemen. Hey, you're going to be all over Michigan this month and next month. Kalamazoo, Saugatuck, Traverse City, Clinton Township, East Lansing, and as you mentioned, Ann Arbor, and a half dozen other dates. What's it like to tour in Michigan versus other states or on the coasts?
Certainly there's the hometown boy and that, you know, there's this appreciation, the fact that I've lived here. And that, so you can kind of feel that home state, home field vibe. The East Coast is great. They are, it's like the ARC audience. They are connoisseurs of acoustic music on the East Coast. Nashville, you go play Nashville. We played the 3rd and Lindsley and City Winery down there 2 or 3 times. That's a whole other vibe, which is, go ahead. But they're listening to every single word. It's songwriters listening sometimes. Those who, you know, decide to go see an actor sing. The West Coast was a little, that's more, you get up to the Northwest, it gets to be fun. Yeah. But the Midwest, you can pull out some of those songs, like Take an I-94. You can pull that song out, and they're going to love it.
Sure, it's going to resonate with them.
You play that in Phoenix, not so much, you know?
We've talked about a lot of things, and not that what we talked about wasn't a lot, but do you have any other projects we're working on that I haven't mentioned?
That's enough for now, I think. Yeah.
All right. Well, in that case, would you take us out with a song?
Okay. Ticking at 94. Shut up, get in, lock the door. Do some highway cruising. Tired of love and losing. Ticking at 94. Ticking at 94.
You can find dates for the Michigan concerts at jeffdaniels.com. Thanks for coming in.
Thank you, Lester.
Support for arts and culture coverage comes in part from the Michigan Council for Arts and Cultural Affairs. Well, it's time for another Artisan of Michigan visit, and this time we go to Detroit. When we talked, the weather was still warm and Babacar Lowe was in his backyard working. Under a tent surrounded by potted plants, he was repairing rattan and wicker furniture, a skill he first encountered in his home country of Senegal.
I did a little bit of weaving, making rattan and bamboo furniture in Africa, just on my spare time. That was my first experience with this. And besides from seeing my grandfather, who was a furniture maker, but regular European style and all that mostly. And when I came here in the 90s, maybe two, 3 years after, I met an old man that was in Hazel Park, Frank Henry. And that's what he was doing. His business was about caning, wicker furniture and all that. And I started over there almost like an apprentice, learning mostly from scratch until he retired and I took the business over.
You know, we're in a throwaway society.
Yeah.
You wear out the caning in a cane bottom chair and it gets tossed out. I mean, that's such a waste.
I see that a lot, you know, and it hurts.
Lowe says he used to see chairs put out on the street for trash pickup and he would take the good ones home, but there are just so many of them. And the fact is, repairing chairs and other furniture is not that cheap.
When I tell people the price to repair it, and they think about how much they pay for the chair, they rather throw it away. So what I'm doing most of the time is antique or valuable that people really have some attachment from family. Those they're willing to pay to have it repaired.
Many, not all, but many of the artisans I've talked with say they like working alone. You can count Lowe among them.
I'm not that sociable, really, when it comes to working. I like my peace and being on my corner doing my work. That's why when you talk about training sometime, it will have to be somebody who can just stay around and watch and learn.
Not be like a reporter and ask a lot of questions.
Not really. I'm not a big fan of reporters, even though I love news. My father was a journalist. I'm not a big talker or answering questions, really. I'm doing my best right now.
I appreciate that. So tell me how people find out about you.
I do a lot of work mostly for company who know me, subcontracting. They do the advertisement and everything. That's most of my business. The rest, I have customers that from word to mouth over the years. And like yesterday, a lady called me. She saw an article that came last year, I think, in the Detroit News about me. And she said she saved the paper, and she called me.
Lowe says his parents wanted him to be a computer programmer. He went to school in France for it, but his heart was not in it. He wanted to work with his hands, work with furniture like his grandfather and his uncle did. He also builds rustic furniture from found wood. We've got some photos on MichiganRadio.org. He'd like to do a lot more of that artwork, but the caning and weaving of chair bottoms, the commercial work, pays the bills. He knows a lot of people would like to turn a hobby into their livelihood, but he says you have to have a certain attitude about it.
If you're into job security, that's fine. You better stick with it. If you're kind of daring and know how to survive, you can start doing something for yourself. You're going to have ups and downs. It's not going to be easy every day. Me on my side, so far, I give thanks.
That's Babacar Lowe with the Wicker Shop in Detroit, our latest Artisan of Michigan. Today's Stateside was directed by Allie Billings and engineered by Rusty Brock, who actually said today that he taught Allie everything she knows. I'm not buying that. You shouldn't either. Contributors are Mike Blank, Danny Hensel, Mercedes Mejia, and Lindsay Scullin. Our executive producer is Joe Lindstroth. I'm Lester Graham. Thanks for listening. Have a great weekend.